See you tomorrow.
Hi, everybody. Happy Monday. Good to have you here. I love record breaking. When I was a kid, my brothers and my sister and I would have this big book, the Guinness Book of World Records. Back then, they were records that were like, you know, running and jumping and eating and all those other things that now they're kind of like, how fast can you spin a plate while you put toe rings on? I mean, it's just today I don't even understand the records. But something happened today in a Maryland courtroom that I think is kind of like getting in there with the records, right? I have seen a lot of verdicts in my day, a lot. I'm a true crime reporter, for heaven's sake. You rarely get a verdict under an hour. You rarely get a verdict that's 46 minutes, especially when the crime is murder and rape and kidnapping and assault. And the punishment means you may go to prison for the rest of your life, no parole. But here we are, that guy on the left accused of murdering, raping, destroying Rachel Morin. We covered this case nonstop as they looked for her killer. And they found him, and they tried him. And that jury, they left the courtroom to deliberate, and here's my guess. They went around the table once. They decided, yeah, not one of us thinks this guy didn't do it, but maybe we should stay here in the room a little longer, because it sure looks bad to have a 5-minute verdict. That's my guess. But this was fast. This was furious. I have the attorney for the family of Rachel Morin on tonight. He's going to tell me a lot more about the observations the moment the guilty verdicts came down. Yes, plural. There were four of them. And also the reaction of that fella, who, by the way, is an undocumented immigrant. So he's been the subject of a lot of talk around the nation, because that gets very political, right? If you get an undocumented immigrant now involved in a murder, it gets way bigger headlines. Did that even come up in court? Wait until you hear all the stuff they had on this guy. And you can decide if you were a juror in that panel, if you'd have gotten a verdict in less than 46 minutes. Okay, also, I've got just a white-knuckle situation to show you out of Santa Fe, New Mexico. I love these videos from police dash cams. I love chases. I will watch a chase for 2 hours to see how it ends. I also rubberneck on the highway, but I don't think I'm unlike a lot of people. And when you see this chase, yes, it is a U-Haul panel truck up ahead. So I wonder how high speed it got. But look where they are. They're going through residential areas. They ended up on freeways. And now I'm going to tell you what was in that truck. Because when I say white knuckle, not just for the cop driving this car, not just for the guy trying to evade him, for the two kidnapped people who were stuck in the back, no seatbelts. Yeah. Now we're talking like serial killer kind of stuff. So I'm going to walk you through this crime, walk you through how the police even found out what was going on in that truck. And you're going to hear from the officers who had to hit the pedal to the metal to catch them. Okay, so that's all coming ahead as well. And then it is today, I always check my watch, April 14th, but I should have known that because it is an anniversary. I told you last week, if you were watching, I'm a huge Titanic nerd. Today is the anniversary 113 years ago when the Titanic went down, hit the iceberg and went down in hours. That ended up being like, weirdly, part of the true crime world because there were so many lawsuits afterwards. Millions and millions of dollars, about $16 million worth of lawsuits were filed against the White Star Company. They didn't pay that much. I'll let you know a little later how much they actually paid out. But it's also the kickoff to a week of crime. These anniversaries came at us so fast and furious, we couldn't cover them all in a week. It is a season of crime, folks. Mid-April, weirdly, is when all the craziest things seem to happen. You want a quick list? How about Lincoln being shot? Columbine? How about Boston Marathon? The bombers? Virginia Tech? All those kids were shot on campus. Then there's Oklahoma City. The Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building was bombed. And then we can't forget Waco, Texas. This all happened this week. What is it about this week in the middle of April that makes it a season of crime? That is all coming in our True Crime Rewind in just a moment, but I'm going to start here. It took 6 minutes, just six, for a jury in Connecticut to find a man guilty of two murders. 6 minutes for two murders, even though there was no DNA, there were no fingerprints, they never found a murder weapon, and there was not a scrap of video of the crime. 6 minutes for 12 people to get into a jury room and make up their minds and then come back to the court with two guilty verdicts. That might be a record. That was back in 2010 after Marquise Hill murdered two people execution style outside of a nightclub. And five people said they saw him do it. Case closed. In contrast, no one saw Rachel Morin's killer violently take her life on a jogging trail in Maryland. No one saw him rape her and violently strangle her before bashing her head in with a rock. No one saw that killer drag Rachel for 150 feet, leaving a trail of blood all the way to the filthy drainage culvert where that killer dumped her body. But there seemed to be little question about who did it today in a Maryland courtroom, because a jury took just 46 minutes to say Victor Martinez Hernandez, an undocumented immigrant from El Salvador, was that vicious killer on the Ma and Pa Trail 2 years ago. 46 minutes, guilty on four counts against him. My guess, he is never going to get out of prison. And if Maryland were a death penalty state, which it is not, I am also guessing that he would be a perfect candidate for the needle, the chair, or the firing squad. But again, it is not, and he is not. Victor Martinez Hernandez, however, will forever be known as the man who took Rachel Morin's life, a mother of five, who was just out for a run in August of 2023. Guilty of first-degree murder, first-degree rape, third-degree sex offense, and kidnapping for good measure. The case, just 9 days long, was so violent, so cruel, and so graphic, we could not air most of it. The killer had no alibi, and the killer lied nonstop. But most importantly, the killer's DNA was found on Rachel, around Rachel, and inside Rachel. After all, this was a rape before a killing. It goes without saying his defense attorney did not have a whole lot to work with, except, you know, to hopelessly point fingers at others. You know, oh, look over there, Rachel's boyfriend. The one and only witness that they called was a digital forensic analyst, because they tried to suggest that Rachel's Google searches might have pointed to a jilted lover. It did not work. Defense put on a 10-minute case. Rachel's boyfriend cooperated with the police from the beginning. He was never considered a suspect. Let's compare and contrast, shall we, with Victor Martinez Hernandez, who, when finally caught last year in Oklahoma, of all places, denied up and down ever knowing anybody named Rachel Morin. Nah, never heard of her, never seen her, don't know her, never been there. Never even been to Maryland, he said. Never been there. Again, his DNA was all over the crime scene and all over Rachel. By the way, here he is being interrogated by the detectives with a little help from an interpreter.
Pero cómo se juran que yo fui.
Well, how can you be sure it's me?
Through DNA.
Por la evidencia que tenemos.
Solo por el ADN.
Sí.
Si es el ADN, cualquiera se lo puede hablar a uno y hacerte daño.
Not in the way that it was left.
Yeah, it's like, that's what you call in a corner, figuratively and literally. He just kept on denying everything. Everything. Never been to Maryland. But cell phone data and security video and his own family said otherwise. As far as Maryland was concerned, oh, he'd been there. Actually, he'd lived there. And he had worked there at a local Popeyes. He even stayed with relatives there, relatives he later claimed didn't exist. You may also remember that months before the Maryland attack, this thing happened. He allegedly assaulted a child and her mother in their home in Los Angeles. But that attack did not even come up in court, even though it was his DNA found. But that attack didn't even come up. Nor did the politics surrounding his unlawful presence in the United States of America. That's important. The politics, the mention of that case, and that did not come up. When the verdict was read, Rachel Morin's mother hugged the prosecutor. But this killer, he didn't show any emotion, nothing, stone cold, before being cuffed and escorted out of the courtroom. I am joined now by the attorney for Rachel Morin's family, Randolph Rice. Mr. Rice, thank you for coming back. It's been very helpful to talk to you through this process, as I can imagine that this has just been so overwhelming for Rachel's family. Take me to the moment where you learned 46 minutes into deliberations that there was a verdict.
Yeah, Ashley, thanks for having me on. And I think you gave a really good overview of this case. You know, I think they probably were looking for a pen just to fill up the jury sheet because it was quick. We were all settled in for maybe a couple of hours. But when you have a verdict come back that quick, the general rule says it's not good for the defendant. And certainly that proved true today when they came back out and read off that jury sheet and said guilty on all the top counts and really just sealed his fate.
So what was the reaction of your clients, Rachel's mom, Patty, and the rest of her family?
Yeah, Patty was tearing up, obviously. I think that this was somewhat of a relief. I think this had been a long 19 months. And while certainly this doesn't change the fact that Rachel's still dead and they're, you know, obviously never going to see her again, it is maybe a hurdle they've sort of overcome getting this conviction, now knowing that this man can never hurt another woman like Rachel Morin again.
Not that we expected Victor Martinez Hernandez's demeanor to change from the way it has been all throughout this case, stone cold when horrifying photographs were paraded across the screens, as they have to be in these cases. But what about the moment where he learned that the guilty verdicts, as he knows, will likely mean he will never get out of prison?
Yeah, really, he has been consistent this whole trial with showing very little emotion. During the trial, he was taking notes. He occasionally looked up at videos. But when they read the verdict, it was just like, no big deal. Stone cold face, like you said in the open. It just was not registering what had just happened to him.
So when they led him out of court, I mean, that's really a moment where oftentimes, and you tell me, victims' family members feel at ease. Because if the killer is there in your presence, you can be relieved, but you really can't feel the weight of your life maybe returning to some semblance of what it was. Tell me a little bit about Patty, the things that she said afterwards, and how she's doing tonight, the mom.
Yeah, I mean, she's exhausted, really. I mean, because this has been a long trial, I think the emotional exhaustion sort of taken a toll on her. When they handcuffed him, almost in a symbolic way, because they typically lead him in and out of the courtroom without handcuffs, but that moment that the deputies all handcuffed him and then led him out of the courtroom really had a moment, an effect on the entire courtroom. And the entire courtroom stuck around. Usually people would leave, but I think everybody actually wanted to see him have those handcuffs placed on him. And then Patty went around and hugged all of the detectives, all the investigators, thanking them. The FBI agents were there. The HSI agent was there. And just thanking them for all the work that they had done in this case.
Did anybody show up for him? Did he have one family member, one friend, anybody, a supporter?
Well, they had the family members there that were testifying against him in the first couple of days saying, oh, yeah, he's been in Maryland, all right. We saw him because he was living on our couch, and they identified him. And, in fact, one of the male family members was not too happy staring him down, knowing that a rapist and a killer was living in his house with his wife and daughter.
I'll bet. And did anyone show up for that verdict?
We didn't see anybody from the family there, no. And we understand that the girlfriend and the baby are still in El Salvador, so there's no family here that would. And look, he's burned every bridge, actually. I mean, from the testimony is he would just sort of bounce around until the family members got sick of him being there. He wasn't paying for things. He was causing a ruckus, and they just kick him out.
Sounds about right. Let me ask you, because when you say El Salvador, that tweaks for a lot of people because, you know, the news has been showing a lot of images of, I think it's called CICOT, the terrorism confinement center in El Salvador. It's that place where all those prisoners are dressed in white shorts, often bare-chested, with their tattoos showing, being marched, you know, with their heads shoved down. We've seen these images nonstop. It's basically a contracted prison in El Salvador that the Americans are putting all of the ICE detainees when they're flying them out of the country. Those are federal processes. This is a state process. But is there any chance that a guy like Victor Hernandez is going to end up being shipped out of American prisons and into this place?
Well, as you mentioned, it's probably a safe bet that he's going to receive life without parole, which means he'll spend the rest of his life in a Maryland Department of Corrections somewhere either on the Eastern Shore or the Western Shore of Maryland. I can tell you they're not very nice places to be. So he will probably die in a Maryland Department of Corrections facility.
And everything's kind of upside down these days with process. I mean, there's a lot of challenges going on to the Trump administration's efforts, whether you like them or hate them. And I just wondered if it would be possible if the federal government would appeal to the Maryland state government and the penal system to try to extract a guy like that, just to make a show of it, to send him down to where not only... Listen, Maryland prisons may not be great, but that prison, you don't see the light of day and you're not allowed visitors ever.
You know, that's an interesting question. And I've had a lot of people ask me that. Do you think that he could get shipped off? And the answer is you never know. I mean, certainly a possibility that they somehow say, hey, look, we want to get this guy out of here. But there could be that worry that, you know, maybe he gets out of there. He somehow comes across the border and we don't have control over him. If we know he's in the Department of Corrections facility in Maryland, we know that he's not going to be able to hurt anybody like a Rachel Morin again.
Well, that makes sense for anybody who's watching thinking, ship him out, send him to the horrible place. You're only as good as the leader of that country in terms of security of that prison. And if there's any falling out between America and El Salvador, who knows what happens to those who America has asked them to guard. So it's a good point to make. Sentencing. Let's talk about sentencing. I don't actually know the date, the plan, what's scheduled or is anything scheduled yet?
Nothing's scheduled yet. The court today ordered what's called a pre-sentence investigation where they'll go in and just get background information about him. And they also ordered a psychiatric and a sexual evaluation as well. Those reports typically take about 60 to 90 days to be done. So we're guessing that probably somewhere around the 90-day period, sentencing will happen. And that's where the judge will have the opportunity to give him that life without parole.
So here's the comment from his team. We are disappointed in the verdict, obviously, which will be reviewed by our team. We will now focus on sentencing and ensuring that Mr. Martinez Hernandez has a fair process that balances all of the relevant factors. I got about 10 seconds left. What factors might help him here? Anything?
They're going to try to find any type of appellate issue, and I'm sure they're going to raise that within 30 days after his sentencing, and then we just have to wait for the appellate courts.
Yeah. Hey, Randolph Rice, I really appreciate you guiding us through this process. And please pass on our condolences to Rachel Morin's mom and the rest of her family.
I will. Thanks, Ashley.
Thank you so much. All right, folks, coming up next, a woman who was nearly pushed off a 1,000-foot cliff before being beaten within an inch of her life sets foot in the last place she wants to be and faces the last person she wants to see. The husband, she says, tried to kill her. We're going to show you the condition she was in and the face-off that followed. That's next.
Thanks for listening to News Nation on the go. I'm Marnie Hughes, and this is America's fastest growing cable news network, delivering fact-based, unbiased news from all sides.
Do you remember the anesthesiologist who allegedly tried to push his wife off a 1,000-foot cliff in Hawaii on her birthday before beating her head in with a rock? That wife showed up in court, cuts, bandages, and all, to face off against him and make sure that he would not get within an inch of her or their kids anytime soon. Right now, Gerhard Koenig is being held without bail for the attempted murder of Arielle Koenig 3 weeks ago, again on her birthday. Arielle says that when she refused to request to take a selfie with him right at the edge of that very dangerous overlook, he bashed her head in with a rock and then tried to inject her with pre-loaded syringes that he had in his backpack. Witnesses said the attack only ended when the husband took off after other hikers came upon the scene. If Dr. Koenig can make bail, he'll get out before his trial. And Mrs. Koenig, who is a nuclear engineer, by the way, does not want to take any chances. So she requested and she got a restraining order to keep him away from the family. While Mr. Koenig was beamed into the courtroom from his jail, Mrs. Koenig showed up with her battered head covered by a black and white scarf and a bandage over her eyebrow. In her petition, she alleged that after the attack, her husband Gerhardt FaceTimed his grown son and fessed up, saying, quote, "I just tried to kill Ari, but she got away," end quote. The petition also alleged that Gerhardt had sexually abused his wife for months, and that after accusing her of cheating on him, he monitored and controlled all of her communications. Arielle had to swear all of this under oath, and Gerhardt was reminded that any of his testimony today could be used against him at trial. Have a listen.
Ma'am, do you recall on your petition, on page 8, there was a line for you to sign your name. Do you recall that?
Yes.
And where you signed, you were indicating the information you provided was true and correct to the best of your knowledge. Is that still the case this morning?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Koenig must make you, sir, aware that this is a civil proceeding, and as the court is aware of your pending criminal charges, I must let you know that anything that you testify to this morning can be used against you. Any questions, Mr. Koenig?
No, ma'am.
Gerhardt Koenig's attorney put out a statement saying, quote, "There are two sides to every story, and thus far only one side has been shared. The other side to this story will be shared within the court process at the appropriate time." And in court, he pointed out that denying bond in a case like this, attempted murder, is unusual.
Pretty commonplace in attempted murder and murder cases over the last 10 years that at least some degree of bail would be set. We see no reason why this case would be any different, especially given the fact that Dr. Koenig has no prior record.
Well, for now, Dr. Koenig is still in jail, and the restraining order stands, and his trial is scheduled for June, so soon. So we will be following it, trust me. Coming up next, hang on for a wild ride. Like the next guy, I love a good police chase, but when I found out what was in the back of this U-Haul truck, it went next level. Here's a hint: kidnap victims, and no, they are not wearing seatbelts in that truck, in the back of that truck. We're going to show you how this chase ended and talk to the daring cops behind the wheel of the cruiser with the dash cam. That's next.
You're listening to Banfield on News Nation's audio stream. Available 24/7 on the News Nation app, or just say, "Alexa, play News Nation."
If you did not know this, a favorite side hustle of mine is to pinch hit for Dan Abrams on the cop show On Patrol Live. It's where we follow police live, the action all over the country with dozens of cameras. It's very, very high octane, super exciting. And the highlight is always seeing the bad guys get what's coming to them. And of course, innocent victims being saved too. And that brings me to a video from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Last Tuesday, a 911 caller said they heard people yelling and banging from inside of a U-Haul truck. And when police tracked down the truck, it tried to pull it over, but no, this is what happened. Of course, the truck gave chase. It was a chase, actually, that went on for miles across highways and through neighborhoods like this. So even after the truck blew out all four tires on spike strips, it just kept driving. But as is usually the case, the driver eventually had nowhere left to go.
Left turn onto Herrera, making a left turn on Herrera.
Thank you.
No, stop the vehicle! Stop the vehicle! Stop the vehicle! Stop the vehicle!
Can we still hear babies from the back of the U-Haul?
Oh my God, it's just heart-stopping to think the people were back there with all that stuff. So you should know that at first the people in the back were handcuffed because the police didn't know what they were dealing with, right? So I know it looks really weird, but then they figured it out pretty quickly, that they were in fact kidnapped victims. The couple in the back said that they had been helping the driver clean out the back of this U-Haul when suddenly he pulled that door down and shut them inside the back of the truck and began to drive away. That driver's name is Stacy Walker, and tonight he is charged with kidnapping, aggravated assault, and fleeing. If it hadn't been for the brave chase given by the Santa Fe Police Department, that couple might not have been rescued, and I shudder to think of where they might have ended up. I am now pleased to welcome both Detective Francisco Sammy Alvarado and Officer Donovan Gonzalez to the show. Guys, congratulations on an incredible collar. I know that's the old lingo when you catch for someone. Officer Gonzalez, that was you behind the wheel of this dash cam video. So that's you driving, and you've got some mad skills for keeping up with this person. First of all, have you ever been involved in a chase like this that ended like this?
No, nothing of this sort, ma'am.
Oh, I'll bet this was a bit of a shock. First and foremost, you had an idea that there were people in the back of the truck, and that must have really limited what you could do in this chase, officer. Tell me about that.
It just made the risk so much more. It took so much additional thinking and so much more resources that were rarely available, thankful to our department as well as assisting agencies in the near vicinity. But that definitely made the chase a lot more risky than it already was, with the potential of lives being lost. As you could see in the driving of that individual, he showed blatant disregard for no one other than himself at that point. And the main goal was to try to get it to stop as soon as possible and save the individuals that were potentially back there upon the initial call.
So Detective Alvarado, because of the work that I often do on Patrol Live, I know that a frequent tactic to stop a fleeing vehicle is a pit maneuver, you know, where you come in on the side and you knock them sideways so that they usually spin out. But again, there were people in the back of that U-Haul. So was the pit maneuver not something that you could use?
It was thought of based on what we had. Obviously, the careless driving, the lack of care about other people's life, coming in through incoming traffic, needing to stop the vehicle was an option. We had that option, but we had to keep in mind there was people behind that U-Haul. So that's, if we flip the U-Haul, rolls over, it gets in a crash, we have two victims in the back of that U-Haul truck. So we got to be concerned of those two lives.
It's so upsetting to see all the loose furniture back there too, and just the potential for massive injury with the way the guy's driving up onto curbs and hitting the brakes and speeding away. And I'm going to get to that in a moment, how they're doing, the two victims who are in the back there. But first, I just want to play, if I can, what came in prior to you guys ending up on this chase. It was the call that came in to 911 because of what was captured on security monitoring. So let's just take a quick look at that. So you can hear the victims in the back there banging and screaming. And clearly that was what the 911 operator was told. So, Officer Gonzalez, tell me a little bit about what you were thinking as you finally got the U-Haul to stop and you were able to open that back door.
I think speaking for all of us generally that was involved was we just wanted to ensure the safety of those individuals. We wanted to make sure that they were okay, because they'd been through probably one of the most traumatic events in their life. And we were, I think myself and Detective Alvarado were definitely so ecstatic that they were alive and well, and that they were able to walk away from that incident in a safe manner.
Speaking of that, safe is one thing, uninjured is another. Were they banged up back there by all the debris and all the way the driver was driving?
Surprisingly not. I'm sure mentally they were pretty drained, but physically they actually came out pretty well.
What did they say happened? How did they end up inside the U-Haul helping? Like, I get visions of Ted Bundy, who used to push his victims into the trunk and then slam the door. And every other serial killer story seems to involve something like that. So actually, I would love you to just sort of weigh in on that. Is that what crossed your mind as well?
Well, initially, I mean, obviously things come to your mind where, like, how'd you get here? What happened? Were you forcibly thrown in here? Or simply you're just helping someone out? It seemed like that was the case. These two people were helping Stacy clean out his U-Haul, helping him move. And he took that opportunity just to do an act of malice and lock him in and take him for a ride that they'll never forget.
Man, I mean, it's just bad luck to have befriended somebody within a day and agreed to help them out. And it's a lesson to all of us. Do not get in a position where you're this vulnerable inside a truck, inside a van, inside a even a leaning into the back of a car. So, okay, tell me this, Officer Gonzalez. We see this, but then we don't see the driver being loaded into the back of the cruiser, being hauled off to jail. What happened after this? What anything that you can tell us about the driver in the back of the cruiser or at the jail?
So, unfortunately, I don't have that information. Assisting officers jumped in and were able to assist us in every which way. They took the reins on that part of it. I could try to get that information at a later time if I could, but from my understanding, he was pretty compliant with us from there.
Wow. And Detective Alvarado, you didn't have any word on what he was like after he was hauled away from the scene?
No, like Officer Gonzalez says, we remain on scene after he was apprehended. We pretty much lost trains of him. We just maintained the scene, dealing with the chaotic scene that we had on scene there.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's another great show I watch all the time, and it's called Jail. And you always get to see what happens after a situation like this when they're being processed into the local jail. I would have loved to see that as well. Congratulations, you guys, and thank you so much for your service. Thank you for keeping us all safe, and thank you for rescuing those two kidnap victims. Your work is really appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Detective Sammy Alvarado and Officer Donovan Gonzalez on the air for us tonight and still to come. April may be full of chocolate bunnies and cherry blossoms, but did you also know that it is considered the season of crime? What exactly is it about this month that lures the crazies to unleash their hell? From the Lincoln assassination to Columbine, Oklahoma City, and Waco, after the break, April's bloody reputation in our True Crime Rewind. Who doesn't love this time of year? The days are longer, the grass is greener, and where I grew up in Canada, it's time to switch to a lighter parka. And yet there's something else about April, and this week in particular, that stands out like a crocus in the snow, and that's crime. I don't know why, but for whatever reason, some of the most infamous and memorable crimes in history happened this very week. Abraham Lincoln was shot dead 160 years ago tonight, April 14th. 1865, at Ford's Theater in Washington. His assassin, as I'm sure you know, was an actor and Confederate sympathizer named John Wilkes Booth. But on this show, we dig deeper into true crime details that most people miss. Like, did you know that just a few months before President Lincoln was shot, John Wilkes Booth's older brother, Edwin, was standing on a train platform in a New Jersey station when a young man fell onto the tracks in front of him. And Edwin Booth grabbed the young man by the collar, hoisted him back up onto the platform, saving his life. I know, it's crazy, but wait, there's more. That young man, saved by Edwin Booth, was Robert Lincoln. Yes, that Lincoln, the son of President Abraham Lincoln. Again, just a few months later, Edwin's brother would kill that kid's dad, the president. It blew my mind. But this week in April is a weird one. It is like full of true crime anniversaries, like the Columbine Massacre on April 20th, 1999, where a pair of 12th graders, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, murdered 12 fellow students and a teacher before taking their own lives. This was the deadliest mass shooting at a U.S. school until the Sandy Hook Massacre in December of 2012. Tonight's True Crime Rewind takes you back 26 years as the Associated Press began to reveal what was happening in that school.
Question was if there had been any other detainments or arrests of any other juveniles. There have been no arrests, no charges filed on any other. The only detainments were yesterday when we took into custody some people and simply questioned them, but they have been released. It appears that some of the bodies were underneath desks and underneath boxes or cubicles, possibly, yes, that they were trying to hide from the ongoing assault that was happening.
Physically, I'm fine, but emotionally, it'll be hard.
If some of our friends, what a friend of mine that was in the library with me, maybe 20 minutes before the whole thing took place, didn't even, no one never even heard from them last night, and their parents were still looking for them. I still haven't heard a thing. They haven't found him, I guess.
A boy that I went to Germany with a month ago for 2 weeks died. So it's pretty hard. He was a senior. So.
Girl's name is Alex.
They never seemed like they would do something like this.
Oh, no one saw it coming at all.
No one saw it coming.
You say that, were they ridiculed a lot?
They were pushed against lockers, called
just everybody looked at them like they didn't belong, didn't fit in.
Our school is based on appearance, and if you don't look like the dress in Abercrombie and Fitch and stuff, then you're not a part of their group.
Thank you very much. We also have to take this moment once again to hammer home to all the children of America that violence is wrong. And parents should take this moment to ask what else they can do to shield our children from violent images and experiences.
It's hard to believe it was that long ago. You know something else? Tonight, This is also an anniversary. The RMS Titanic struck an iceberg and sank off the coast of Newfoundland 113 years ago tonight. And while it's not a true crime, it did result in civil lawsuits that paid out over $500,000 from the White Star Company that was the business behind that ship. Even though it was like $16 million in lawsuits launched, paid out about $500,000. Coming up next, if your mom killed your little sister and your little brother and is accused of killing your stepdad, I imagine that you'd have something to say about it. And Colby Ryan did. He is the only surviving child of Lori Vallow, and he unloaded on his killer mom from the courthouse steps in Arizona. And yeah, you bet, we're playing it next.
I'm Leland Vittert, and you're listening to News Nation, news for all America. To find News Nation on your screen, go to joinnn.com.
Pretty sure the only opinions Lori Vallow cares about right now are the opinions of the jurors deciding if she murdered her husband, her fourth husband, Charles Vallow. And if you feel like you've been to this rodeo already, you have been. She murdered her own two children and the woman who was married to her lover, who would become her fifth husband. But every murder deserves to be tried separately. So here we are in Phoenix, Arizona, though she'll probably be locked up for life in Idaho. I know, it is a lot. So just imagine if you're the one surviving son of this woman having to watch all of this play out on the sidelines. Colby Ryan is that son, and he spoke to a reporter just outside the courthouse where his mom is both defendant and acting as her own lawyer.
I can't believe this is my family. I can't believe that's my mom, and I can't believe they're all here talking about the people that I grew up with in my direct